little nervous, so you notice that. I think I have too much material, so I probably skip some parts at the end. But what I want to do is that everybody gets what I'm saying. So I'm doing questions in between sections. Feel free to ask anything you want, not including my private life, please. Some of it. Okay. This, you can read it. I won't. What is it talk about? It's some stuff that could be used on pen tests, could be used on intuitions not under contract. It's techniques, ideas. Basically, it's I think some stuff that it's being used out there, but nobody's really talking about it, or nobody did on internet because Google does not know about it, so it's not there. And what else? We've been using these techniques for a couple of years now. Some of it, especially the first part of it, we've been using it fairly successfully. And then for the last part of the talk, it's some ideas we have. We've been able to do some proof of concept tools to try them, and they kind of work. But again, they are probably not new, and they are probably not good. But yeah, we subjectively like them, so I show them. This is mainly for pen testers, hackers, and especially for the people buying services, buying pen test services, because I think that some people is selling pen testing services, and it's only a voice scanning thing, or if it's not that, then it's probably something good, but the client can't tell, does not have tools to, or knowledge to know if what he's buying is good or not. Because suppose it's the first pen test they buy, and they like what they find because they find some bugs, so they go again with the same people. But it turns out to be that these people is not good for market standards. So I think we should teach the clients to be hard with us. Why have we done it? It's just happened mostly. Yeah, it's some stuff we found while doing pen tests, some stuff we found while writing code, writing a product. It's actually, it's some stuff that came out on lunch. We started talking about it, and it looks like, oh, this is a good idea. Let's think a little more about it. So what's yeah, that's pretty much why we have done it. We like it. We've been using it. We just spent some time thinking about it, what it done, and here it is. So it's just the face of all the team back in Argentina and in Boston, especially the Core Labs team doing research there, because they are who put most of the time in it. But pen test people, like the consulting people, throw a bunch of good ideas on it, and the people doing products also help a lot, and we are all together working on it, and everybody is using these things we found for different stuff. So again, I'm not sure if this is cutting edge or rock science or what. I'm just talking about something I couldn't find on the internet, so it'd be there now. Yeah, I'm not going through the outline, just keep going. Now, I want you to think about either your current intuition or pen testing practices, or the practices of the consultant working with you. Think about it. My idea was for you to throw me ideas on how a pen testing is done these days. If anybody wants to do it, I'd be happy to hear it, but if not, I'll just keep going to have some more time. So, anybody has a clear idea of how a pen testing methodology is? Some? And want to raise your hand? I guess you do, but I'll just keep going. This is pretty much the standard methodology I could find on the internet. What we did is using only public information, so I may be missing something, created a matrix comparing what everybody says they are doing when doing pen tests, okay? So I have company, a column for each company or hacking team or whatever, yeah, whoever is publishing the methodology, and a line for each thing they are doing. What we found is that more or less everybody is doing just the same, although they put different names on it. And some people is doing some more stuff, some people is missing some stuff, some people split one of these steps on the pen test on two, or some people shunt them. But pretty much everybody's doing the same. So let me go through it. The pen test usually starts with the information gathering phase, where the auditor, hacker, whatever, is trying to learn as much as possible from the target, okay? The target network, or, yeah, let's say it like that. With that information, they move to detecting possible intrusion vectors, detecting vulnerabilities, either using a bool scanner or core mapping, banner grabbing, comparing versions, or many other ways to do it, I think. After they found some probable intrusion vectors, they move to the attack phase. That's pretty clear. After that, they escalate privileges, not only locally on the box they own, but also to the internal network. That would be penetration. Sorry. Oh, I can move. This is good. Yeah. Is it working? Yep. So after getting into host, probably, not necessarily, gaining more access to that host, they move to the internal network. Okay, and then let me add that before everything starts, you get together with a client or with your friends and define a goal, how far you want to go. For commercial pen tests, you put a time window and a limit on how much time you want to spend on it. For non-commercial, it just happens. You get bored and stop doing it. And after everything's done, cleanup comes, reporting either to the client or to your friends on IRC. Yeah, it's kind of reporting. And I forgot something here. Oh no, it's coming later. Yeah. Some people say they are doing this. After gathering information, some people say they are planning based on that information. Okay? I think it does make a lot of sense to me to plan. Some people is doing just after the first phase of information gathering. Some people is doing after the bone scanning. Some people is not doing it at all. Okay, I find it very smart to do it, and I go over it again and stress that point. And just a few of those publishing methodologies says that once you get into box and are ready to go to the internal network or go beyond that, the loop starts again. Okay, you gain another host, the capabilities you have now are different, the visibility of the network may be different, so you do information gathering again. It's not that you discard everything, but add more information. there's something we want to put with these words is like the principle of conservation of information. It's like nothing should be lost. If you learn it, don't forget it, because you probably use it. So this is pretty much a methodology that we talk about. Oh yes, all what is out there written. Okay, somebody may be doing something different, but I couldn't find it. I spent some time on it, decent time. Yeah, there is something else about this. Between privilege, escalation, and penetration in that zone, some people do something called base camp development. It has to do to basically copy all the tools you want to use to that new host so you can start again from that point. Okay, you probably got into box and want to do Nmap from that box. So if Nmap is not there, you need to copy it, probably compile it. Or if there is not a compiler, you need to get a friend's box that pretty much fits your needs and compile it, etc. So Basecamp development would be that, and would be, if you're doing it, setting up backdoors and stuff. It's about keep going and ensuring that you'll be able to keep going, basically. There are lots of problems with this. Portability, compilers, and I don't know, finding the right tools. You may have some tools that you may use only from Linux, and you got into Windows, and you can't compile it, and then you miss some mobility. I'm not talking about it anymore, so that's what I wanted to talk on it. Any questions about this or comments? I just move forward if you don't ask. Yeah. That's cool. Okay, he's saying that previous to what I show, I think it's a phase of setting up your own environment. Some people say SensePost. I think SensePost has a very clear methodology, and I really like what they are doing and saying they are doing. And they talk about setting up the environment you are going to use to launch your attack. I would include getting zombies running into that phase. He told me that there is another phase that is setting up zombies or preparing for a distributed denial of service attack. Yes, there is. Yep, I just don't put it because nobody really says they are doing it except SensePost. Any other questions? Fine. So, more targets. I said in the initial phase, you first define what's going to be your target. You define it, for example, the network you're going to target. Okay, so what I'm going to show you is more kind of targets. Host is a more clear target. There is host. I would target this host. I want to enter to this host. So that's pretty clear. Networks, your goal could be, say, I want to enter some host on this network, and you have a net block and a mask. So that's another way of expressing target. We're very used to hosts or networks, and some of us are used to talking about organizations as targets. Actually, I couldn't find anybody saying that targeting organizations is really different, but again, SensePost is doing it. We are also doing it. Okay. Yeah, if I'm talking about them, I can talk about us. It's and then the most interesting target I'm going to present on my point of view is persons. Targeting persons, I think, is today the more easiest way to get into an organization. We'll see why I think that. I try to explain it. Anything else? Yes, appliances, targeting appliances, printers. Where is FX? I saw you coming in, FX. Where are you?
he's just gonna,
Targeting appliances is another very juicy thing to do. Why I'm talking about more targets, because as part of a pen test, I think you need to test the whole infrastructure. And there is no doubt persons and appliances are part of it. And in fact, did I say it already? Persons are the weakest link into the infrastructure, the security infrastructure. I tried to convince you of that. Let me just talk for one slide about what would be targeting an organization. The idea is, before that, is that I think that every new kind of target you discover, new kind, I mean host, organizations, persons, every new kind, we open new dimensions in the tools, exploits, and information you can use or gather. That's what I'm presenting them so clearly differentiated. So let's talk about organizations. I think that when you start the pen test or intrusion and you are doing a whois, DNS, crawling, some transfers, website crawling, what else? That kind of things is not learning things about a host, it's not learning things about a network, it's learning things about an organization. That's what I think these very common things come into this place. Let me say, for example, you could try to gather all the information you can about all the commercial relationships or all the trust relationships between two organizations. If one organization is a provider to your target, you could assume or find that there is a VPN, for example, between these two organizations, or there is at least a trust path to go from one to the other. So it might be a good idea to take the indirect path if the VPN lets you get into the internal network directly and the second organization is weakest into security terms. So it's kind of easy to find these commercial relationships. For example, if a company is saying that they are using Linux and they have some partnership with Red Hat or with Cisco or HP, well, you know a lot of things about them already. You know that they are using Linux on HP, probably, and they are using Cisco's, or they are using Red Hat, or that kind of things. That helps a lot. Well, if we are talking about organizations, it's obvious that the perimeter is not the last step for the intruder. Most emphasis is put on securing the firewalls, securing the web servers, going as deep as the DMZ goes, and pretty much that's it. I'm generalizing, of course. An organization is a lot more than that. It's all the workstations in there, all the people involved, policies, uses. It's more than that, okay? It's the people is part of it, basically. By looking at shop offers, you could tell what they need. You could tell they are using wireless, or they just move into wireless, actually. And then you could say, okay, if they just move into it because they are looking for people, they may have some bugs. You could use resumes because, for example, on my resume you could read that I work on this company and that I can code Smalltalk and that I know some Linux, and you could guess that that company I work for was using some Smalltalk on Linux. It may not be that easy, of course, but some people put, I work in this project where I learn all these things. That's a lot of information again. And again, the people after the workday ends goes to their home, uses their computers. The people is people. So we can use that too. Well, physical security, that's obvious. And then denial of services, it's not like, you may say that you are denying a host or a network, but you're pretty much denying the website of the organization. So I think it's an attack to the organization. Okay? And public image attacks moves a little into information warfare, not just security, but it's an attack on the organization too. Let me talk about personal targets. This, I think, is very juicy. Actually, I'm not sensible, but Rolf, on his talk, is going to talk about it again, I think. Although he's not putting it as person as targets, I think that's what he's talking about. How can you attack a person? Email is a nice vector, and I'm talking about exploits gaining access to the host, okay? Giving you code execution privileges. You could use emails, you could target ICQ, you could target CASA, or you can also target client-side software. Like the SSH client has a bug, you can, if you go to a server, you can probably launch a ping-pong attack. It's you exploit the client, when the client connects to another server, you exploit the server, then you set up their everything, so when somebody else connects to it, you exploit him and our server, so it's like ping-pong attack. How are we going to represent a person? Their email account, their ICQ number, probably their phone number, the SSH identity, the PGP key. That things are what's going to be a person for us. So keep that in mind. What's an impersonation attack? It's, for example, sending an email on somebody else's name to a third person. And here you can see two different victims. One is the final destination of the email, but then the victim of the impersonation attack is the person you are impersonating. If you have their PGP key or some other credentials, you can do pretty nasty things. Use the front door, not the back door. That's it's not a nice line for it. It's actually getting into a sysadmin's computer at home and bouncing in into the organization. This already happened at least twice, as far as I know, but I think it happened more than that. It's we go back to these ideas, and this is the only legal aspect I'm going to talk about. It's you are hacking into somebody else's computer. You have a contract with the company you are working for, but hacking his box at home. I've been talking to Andrea, who's going to do the talk on the law thread. She advised me on that. And first thing she said is that if you are going to do a pen test using these techniques, you may want to talk to a lawyer first. And then he said also that if the computer you are going to break in is from the company, you may be okay with that, because it's mostly okay. But if it's the employee's company, it may get a little more messy. So it's delicate. And then these kind of attacks are already known, okay? What I'm stating here is that this is almost the more easy thing to get into an organization. This is what I'm stressing here, and we go through it. But it's been used already. I'm not saying it's new. Somebody call it client-side exploits. Somebody call it exploiting the workstations, and we call it targeting the persons. But it's almost the same. And then last time I was at CANSEC, I saw Lance speaking about honeypots. And that's easy to do, looking at him. He always talks about honeypots. So. He said something I really like. It's internal honeypots. That deploying honeypots in the internal network. And I shampered it because suppose you using targeting a person, you get into some workstation, then if you are going to penetrate farther than that computer, you are probably going to scan or do some more port mapping or do some information gathering. So if there is a honeypot on the internal network, we are most likely to hit it. And that's a very, very clear idea that something weird is going on. Same thing for IDSs on the internal network. I haven't seen too many internal honeypots or internal IDSs deployed, but I think it's a good idea. Sorry. This is the architecture of our person exploits. It's very simple, but it let us see some stuff. The attacker first sends, suppose it's an email, sends the email, or sees the CASA network with the exploit, or sends the ICQ message, and that attack vector will be stored on a server. Okay, on the mail server, probably on the ICQ server if he's not connected, on your box when it's CASA or on some distributed network. And then at some point, the victim will connect to that server and download the exploit, and the exploit will get access to his box. And then you don't really know when this is going to happen. So at that time, the exploit will connect back to the attacker box where we set up a listening console. Something's listening and waiting for the victim to connect. And in some cases, you may get more than one connection. Okay? We go through this again and see some weak points on the scheme. But this is pretty much, you send something and wait. And then somebody gets it, gets exploit, and connects to you. Some pros on this for the exploit writer or attacker. Good things for the attacker. Workstations are way less maintained than servers. There are patches for Outlook pretty often. And there are patches for Apache or IIS or whatever sometimes. But an administrator will quickly jump into fixing the servers, but will hardly jump and stay all night awake fixing the workstations, fixing the 5,000 workstations on the company. And it's pretty common to find different versions of the software on different workstations. Very common to find that. The enemy is less skilled. Why? Because when you are targeting a server, the enemy is the administrator, or probably the security guy on the company. But when you are attacking a workstation, although the administrator may get involved, the first person to notice the attack is the user of the workstation. It's the public relations lady or guy. It's the help desk people. It's people that has not been trained for security. So the enemy is less skilled. They are hardly going to notice that there is something going on, something that they should report going on. Probably because they are used to see the program crashing. It's easy to see workstations with lots and lots and lots of software installed. All that comes with the operating system is hardly removed from workstations. That includes, in most cases, some media players, email readers, web browsers, and then you have PDF readers. All the Office suite on Windows is probably installed. And lots of things that may be target, and lots of bugs out there because this application has not been reviewed for security reasons until late days. I mean, Apache has been for, I don't know, I can say 5 years already, let's say 3 years already for security reasons, the client-side software has not been updated that well. So it's very likely to find one intrusion vector on a workstation because there are more software, because servers are cut down to the last thing needed to make it work. Yeah. When you are targeting people, you have more targets because there is usually more, except for Google probably, there is usually more people than servers. Google has like 10,000 servers, so this is a weird case. But on an organization, it's very common to find more people. So you have more targets to pick. Okay? These are all good things for the attacker. When you get into workstation, you get right into the inside, past all the firewalls. Okay, you don't need to. You may need to set up a cover channel or some communication channel. We see that, but you get right to the inside. Okay. If all the strength was put on the borderline, on the firewalls and servers, you don't really care, because you went through it. And then. This is, diversity is better for the attacker. That is, it's commonly said, or was said, that, for example, using different firewalls, it's more secure because it's pretty uncommon that somebody will find an OD for your Linux firewall, and then an OD for your OpenBSD firewall, and so on. But in this case, diversity is better. I mean, if not everybody has the same version of the main reader installed, and you can do a spam. You can spam there with an exploit, although your exploit may work on only one specific version of the mailer, it's pretty likely that you hit one with that version. Okay, that's different from what it is with servers. Not really. Then. Bad things for the exploit writer. Tougher tuning. Brute forcing. Tougher brute forcing. You don't really have feedback with the exploit. You just launch it, wait, don't know when it's going to hit, and hope that it worked. You don't really have a channel established when the exploit takes or tries to take control of the box. So tuning is tougher on these cases. But remember what the last thing I said, that diversity is better. So even if you only have one specific exploit for one specific version of some program, if you can mass attack all the people or some people in the organization, it's likely that this parallel brute forcing will work. It's like instead of doing brute forcing serially, you are doing it on parallel. It may be more noisy, especially if you are going to spam or do a mass attack, and especially if it's going to pop up a window when it fails or if it works. But it may not be more noisy. This matches with the good thing that is the victim is less skilled, so it kind of compensates. Asynchronous nature is this thing I've been repeating, that you throw the exploit and don't really know when it's going to work, or you don't know if it was already seen by the victim and it didn't work, and you don't really know how many people is going to connect back to you. There's one very interesting thing that happened to us. This guy at Core who found the RPC buffer overflow on Snort was working on the exploit. And he has his test box set up and launched the exploit, and two connections came back because he exploited somebody else's laptop that was running Snort too. So you have to be ready to receive as many connections as possible. And then another thing that is bad is that when the exploit takes control of the box, you don't have a communication channel established with the exploit. This is, you don't have you can't have at first an interactive shell because there is no connection. The big team connect to this to the mail server or to the ICQ server. They did not connect to you. So you somehow need to reestablish the communication channel. On some cases, opening a TCP connection would be enough. On some cases, you need to tunnel it over the HTTP proxy. On some cases, you need to do some more advanced, hidden channels. It has a name. So this is something you need to work on when you are doing these kind of exploits, but it's something that can be solved on most of the cases. Uptime. This is a big difference between hidden servers and hidden workstations, but it's not really a problem. Workstations are supposed sometimes to be powered off at night. But on the contrary, servers are supposed to be up all the time. So if you get into server, it's pretty likely that your connection may be used over and over and over without having to reestablish it. But when it comes to attacking workstations, you need to do something to reestablish the connection when the box boots up again. It's pretty simple, but it's something you need to have in mind. And then this is pretty much what let us think that when you find a new kind of target, it comes with a whole dimension to think about. Let me just show you five examples of information gathering tools specifically done for gathering information on persons. You could map the internal network using email headers. That's possible to do if they are not filtering headers. Like if there are several SMTP servers in the internal network and an email goes like hopping, you see all the servers. So you have some information on the internal network. Person discovery tools, it's a term that I really like. It's think about host discovery tools. This is person discovery tools. Crawling Google is a very nice example. Crawling groups.google.com, starting with the domain, is a very nice example and gives you a lot of information. Using ICQ white pages, using PGP key servers, using eBay users, using, I don't know, all that kind of things that lets you get a bunch of information. You just type the domain and get a lot of email addresses back. Another person discovery tools, I would say, is the very old trick of using verify or expand on SMTP servers. That very old tool is like brute forcing addresses. Falls into this category, I think. Then another very interesting tool you can do related to the previous one is crafting a profile on a given person. How you can do that? You could do it if you can access it through what they are selling on eBay or their homepage, or you could do it just looking at what email lists he subscribed, either looking up on Google or playing some more tricks. And very close to that is drawing trust relationship graphs on people. Like if two people are talking on some subject and on a public email list, you may assume that they know each other and that there is a trust relationship. So you can exploit that to craft an email that you are sure your target will read. The same thing goes for PGP trust chains. And there is a site, I forgot the name, that lets you see, it's to see the 6 degree of separation to anybody that is registered. If you are in a group, you can see who trusts who on that graph. That's very interesting because when you are sending an email, or sending an ICQ message, you need to be sure that the person is getting it. Basic. This may require human intervention to craft a nice email, but it can be done. Another tool is OS detection and application detection for persons. It's like, what email is he running on what operating system? What ICQ client is he running? Is he using, I don't know, that kind of things you need when targeting a person and using an exploit. You would probably need to know the service pack. Well, Outlook comes with a pretty nice, every email sent with Outlook comes with a pretty nice header that tells you the version down to 2 points of, like, it's 5.4 numbers. That's, you can have a mapping from that to service pack, kind of. And then reverse traceroute is another nice tool. I'm just throwing at you some examples so you can start thinking that there is a new dimension to tools, okay? Reverse traceroute is opening a port on your box, and when somebody connects to you, answering with different ETLs. You could probably map through the firewalls, through a stateful firewalls, to the internal network and see how far the guy is, okay? This is, I'm going really slow. Using this together with emails is very nice because you can send an HTML image tag embed on an email and force the quick preview feature of the email client to connect to your site, and then you automatically launch a reverse traceroute. Any questions? I'm moving out of personal targets. Yeah, he's saying that when you get into somebody's computer, all the privileges you get is his. I say, yeah, that is true. But he can be the CEO. I mean, he could be the security guy too. But then you can, even if he's not, even if he's just a simple user with no real information on his box, you are already on the internal network. And usually, yeah, but you can do TCP. You can open new TCP connections from his box. You can do port mapping, network discovery from his box. You can do everything. You can do everything you would do after passing all the firewalls and getting into the internal network. I mean, if you go through the firewalls to the web servers, you are getting some passwords to start with. But then you would probably want to go inner. So I think it's another approach. I'm not saying that you would only use this. The idea is to use a workstation to set up your base camp there and then go from the inner network. Sniff, you can sniff from there and see sensitive stuff. Any other questions? I can't talk about that. What I would recommend is, it comes down to shellcode. Right, because you are exploited. Sometimes it comes down to shellcode. If you're only talking about Trojans, there's no shellcode. He double click on an exe file, you got the box. You wrote the tool on C, you can do anything. But what I would recommend to block on those who want to prevent this is what I would recommend you is using HTTP tunneling over a proxy. On Windows, there is a global setting for proxy. And there's even a, I think it's COM object or something you can use to do HTTP requests over the already set up HTTP proxy. If the guy can browse the web, he can go outside. Well, if he's reading email and if he has a web browser, if there is a proxy, the setting should be there. I mean, that's the easiest way to do it. I would first try TCP connection. If it fails, try tunneling over HTTP. And then if it fails, I would go using some weird mechanism. What's the word for this? Thank you. Trying to find some cover channel, like, I don't know, something, DNS. SMTP. I think DNS will work always. Like tunneling over DNS will always work. You could do something to stop it, but is that okay? Any other questions? Okay, I'm going on. Remember I said that planning was a nice idea? Well, I was talking about planning after the information gathering tool, after the information gathering phase, sorry. Now, what I'm going to introduce is the idea of planning before the information gathering phase. It's like starting it all, planning. It makes sense, right? Again, I think everybody's doing it, or most of the people is doing it, but nobody's saying they are doing it. We are not saying we are doing it because we realized it just a couple of months ago. So first thing is, it does make sense to plan, right? This is the current practices for information gathering. You first establish a network or a host range you want to attack, figure out which hosts are alive, do some trace route, map the firewalls, do some stuff, probably in a different order, okay? Fingerprint some boxes or use application detection to know the OSs, port map to identify some target services, do binary grabbing, probably run a boom scanner to find out what you would target. This is pretty much the common and current practices. Well, this is pretty much how everything starts on a pen test. This is how we are doing it, how we've been doing it for the last 6 years. But we're about to change it, at least a little. You don't need to answer this, but do you really use everything you learn on the information gathering phase? Do you really, is there any use for the knowledge that the discard port is open? I mean, it could be used, if that is the only port open, it could be used to fingerprint the host OS. But that's pretty much all there is for it, I think. I don't know, you could, I mean, does it really matter to you? You don't really need to know which ports are used if you are not going to use the knowledge. And that's pretty much the basic idea of why planning is good. Does it help to know the operating system of every box out there, or only the box you are going to exploit? Or if the exploit only works on one box, does it really matter? If the exploit only works on one OS, does it really matter to know what the OS is before? It probably does. It probably doesn't. But if there is a decision, you need to think about it. Okay? Whenever you think it probably does, it probably doesn't, or whenever you think it depends, that's the whole point I want to make clear. It depends. You need to plan it. So is it really worth using a bone scanner? I don't know. Probably is. Let me show you a very, very, very simple example of how planning could be done. Suppose my goal is to get access to a given host, a given IP. And what I have is the IP of the target host, and I have, of course, control of my box. And I can do, these are the things I can do. I can test if a given port is open. I can exploit an SSH running on an OpenBSD. I can exploit WFTPD on a Linux. I can exploit IIS on Windows, of course. I can exploit Apache on a Linux. Suppose this is pretty much all I can do, okay? So what I'm going to do is plan the attack based on the only things I can do. There's a catch to that. So, I will not. There is one slide about it. It's I moved out of person. Yeah, it is probably, but nobody's doing it. So yeah, actually, some people is doing it. Nobody's saying they are doing it until now. Some people is finding it out. I'm going to go through that, okay? But not very deep. Sorry. So to get into the box, I need to execute one of the. Is everybody getting bored? Sorry about that. I was afraid that could happen. To get into the box, I need to use one of my exploits. So every exploit has a need for an open port. So I'm building a graph on dependencies. Okay. So I need to know if the port is open, and the way to do that is to use the port prove, and then that runs on my box. So the plan out of this would be prove only ports 22, 80, and 21. There is a catch to this. I go through it. Prove only ports 22, 80, and 21. Furthermore, first prove port 80, because I have two exploits for port 80. And it makes sense to start with higher probabilities of success. Then there's also more probabilities that port 80 is open than port 22 is open. So that's another reason why port 80 should be tested first. Then if port 80 is open, I'll try my exploits. Okay, I have somehow to decide if I'm going to use the IIS exploit or the Apache exploit. I'm not talking about that, but here. But if I find the port 80 open, I just launch the exploit. And that means that my nmap line will not have the three ports on the common line. We'll only have one. And furthermore, I could probably do it manually. It's just one. It's a very simple example again. And if the exploit fails, I keep proving the other parts. We are only planning for tools we already have. That's bad. That's bad, but still, I think using Google to find exploits while you are doing a pen test is not a good practice. So if it's not because you need to know your tools beforehand, or because you don't will not have the time to find the tools later, it may be a good idea to plan only for the tools you have. Okay, we go through this again. We are only planning for services on standard ports. So I'm not going to get a vulnerable web server on port 8080. Not like this. I need to do something else. It was a very simple example. Very simple goal. Different priorities will influence the plan. Suppose one of the exploits is very noisy, and I care about noise, so I would probably leave that for the end, even if it's the more successful, the exploit with more success probability. We'll go through that again too. Do we really need to port proof? I think we don't. We could just launch the exploit. Because if the first thing the exploit is doing is connect, it will just fail. Okay, so you probably want to do it, probably you don't. It depends. So you need to plan it. How could we use an OS detector on this plan? I don't know. Probably to differentiate between Linux and Windows on port 80. This is a little more complex. Exploit, it's just the same, but I can tell if a host is alive. And my goal now is to exploit all possible hosts on a given network, not just one host, okay? I want to get into every host I can. So the plan is, the graph is pretty similar. I have the exploit that will give me access to the box. I have some nibs for the exploit on ports. And then every exploit needs to know the target host. So the port probe will tell me if the port is open, and the host probe will tell me if the host is alive. And those run on my box. So how does the plan go? I will not use ping. That's the first thing I will do, not use ping. Why? Because I don't really care if the host is alive. I only care if the port is open. Okay? Then, again, I will first prove port 80, probably across the net. First, port 80 on every host. On each host is open, I launch the exploit. Then, keep proving other ports, launch the exploits, and then, when I'm done proving port 21, 22, and 80, and launching the exploits, I will use the host probe now. I will use ping to know what other hosts there are that does not have these three ports, any of these three ports open. Probably I know that already because they are answering resets. So, and then for those hosts that I couldn't get into, I will prove non-standard ports, only for those hosts. Okay, you see, it's not like building a big Nmap line with a bunch of ports. It's going step by step. So global statistics will help decide if you want to use first Windows exploits, because most of the hosts out there are Windows, or you want to use Linux exploits because most of the hosts or there are Linux, will help to know if you want to start using port 80 or 22. Global statistics may be cut down to specific areas. Let's say e-commerce sites will have port 443 open, and I will probably start with that port. So having global statistics about topology and all that kind of things helps a lot in planning. Yeah, we were on the first example, we were only planning for services on standard ports. Now we're not only doing that. We saw how we can do that. If we know after we try port 80, if we know that it's likely to be a web server running on port 8080, I will try it. If it's likely to be on 8000, I will try it. And then if everything fails, I will probably do a full port scan. Again, different priorities will influence the plan. That's clear. And then, do we really need to host proof? Can I just launch the exploit? Or just launch the port proof? I don't know. It depends. It's probably less noisy to do a ping, although there is no real reason to do pings. Well, there is, but how can we use a noise detector on this plan? I don't know. It does make sense to use one, but sometimes it's more noisy. There are signatures for Snort for Nmap trying to fingerprint the host, and for Xprove trying to fingerprint a host. So if you can just go to a straight connection and get the banner, you will probably not want to use an OS stack fingerprinting tool. Any questions about this? We see very little about using this with persons. Any questions about this? Okay, let me answer your question. There is one thing when you are using targeting persons, that is, when you are targeting persons, you don't really know how long will it take to for the exploit to be successful. So if you are going to leave that for the last day, the victim will probably connect to you when the pen test is over. So you will probably want to do it near the beginning, okay? Any other questions? Sorry. That was not the question. Okay. Okay, I'm going to introduce to some of you some things we got from a different field. these things we borrowed from combat tactics. So it's still attacks, but on real war and on person as targets probably too, but physical persons. We thought it might be interesting to see what they are doing, and it turned out that it is interesting. So the first thing I want to introduce to you is the OODA loop. It's a voice cycle. It's just the same. There is a guy named Sean Boyd. I don't remember his rank, but he had some rank. He found out that there is a loop that whoever is doing it faster will have a great advantage. The loop is to observe and look around, then find out where you are and what you could do, decide what you are going to do, and then do it, and then cycle. Okay, it's on attacks. Okay, so the people is coming, look around, and then think, what can I do from this point on, decide, and then do it, and then cycle. And this applies to short periods of time and long periods of time, like planning all the attack or just a small operation. And this is very similar to what we are doing. I go through this again. Okay, I'm missing the right point, the whole point. It's what he says is that on an attack, the side who's cycling this loop faster will probably win the battle. That's a very clear statement. And since we are under cyber warfare attack scenarios here, it may apply to us. And I think it does apply to us. Another interesting thing is that there is a very clear differentiation between maneuver versus attrition warfare. Mainly, maneuver warfare is planning and basically using the OODA loop on the plan. I may be saying everything wrong because I just read a couple of papers on this. So. And then attrition warfare is basically throwing all your firepower against the target. Okay? The difference is pretty clear if you think that script kiddies will likely use attrition warfare, and pen tester and highly skilled hackers will use maneuver warfare. Why I'm putting these topics on the table? Because there is a lot of studies on these topics, and there is a lot of time spent studying these things. So I think we may benefit a lot on reading that kind of literature. And yeah, the two following topics are a very interesting difference we found between real combat situations versus cyber warfare scenarios is that on real combat, it's likely that you are attacking somebody that if you are not fast enough, he will attack you. Okay? And that's mainly, I think, this is my opinion, this is mainly why the speed of the loop is so important. Because if you stop to think for too much, he's faster, he will just come before. So, and then on cyber warfare scenarios, the defense is pretty static. We go through this again, but the defense is not attacking the attacker. It's not counterattacking. That's not likely to happen except on some close circles. Yeah, and then we can see some attacker versus attacker wars on internet too, and that would be hackers versus hackers, and that's happening a lot lately. And then another interesting difference is that the OODA loop is a very clear concept, and it's a cycle where the timing is very important. And then we can think about technology races or arms races as another another place where timing is critical. This is not literally, but it's timing is critical. Yeah. Can we leave that for the end? Because I try to remember, but if I don't, you should do it, please. This is a very interesting topic. We'll go through some of that points too, but the question, we'll do it at the end. Yeah. So there are these two different things where timing is critical: the OODA loop and technology races. We see, right now, we see some examples of them. Okay, first the defensive examples. This is a loop. The bug comes out, the patch comes out, the system is patched, and then the sysadmin comes into an idle state where he waits for more patches. Okay? And then why this may be interesting, because if you could measure how long it's taking for the organization to patch their systems, you may know how much time you have to attack them once you know they have a bug. Okay? Timing here is critical. The faster they patch it, the safer they are. Another timing issue is what do they do and how fast they do it, since how do they react to an attack? Is there a plan for answering to an IDS or logs or alerts? Is there a plan or not? Do they just improvise? The timing there is also very critical. Okay? It's what do they do and how fast they do it. How fast do they react to a vulnerability scan or a pen test or external audit? This is also a time where they know they have bugs and they are on the process of fixing them. And that is another place where timing is critical. You could say that you can get these ideas and apply them to your organization and see how they apply to you. Like, do you have a plan for reacting and that kind of things? How you could measure it. How long is it taking for us to react to an attack? And then there is a nice difference, interesting difference, between the timing from an internal wound scan or pen test and the timing from an external audit is that there is a third party who knows your bugs and you are still on the process of fixing them. You have a contract signed, you have everything, but yeah, Andrea, the lady doing the presentation on the law threat, she also advised me that it would be very tough to prove that the auditor used the information to get into the organization, because anybody else could have discovered it independently. So this time is also critical between the bug is told to you by the auditor and you fix it. You probably should start fixing it before the pen test ends. And you probably should require your auditor to tell you the bugs while they are finding it and not just at the end, and work pretty close to them. These are defensive cycles, and we could only find three offensive cycles. One is the information gathering, analysis, planning, and attack cycle. This maps one-to-one to the OODA loop. It's information gathering, planning, information gathering, analysis, planning, attack loop. When you get into a new situation, this maps one to one, and I think it's pretty interesting to see how we could use it. Then another offensive cycle is while doing a pen test, you find the service, probably already triggered some alerts, find the bug on the server, because you port scan and then plan on that. Code the exploit if you need to code it, and here it comes a lot of time coding the exploit, debugging it, making it work independently of the version of the target, whatever, and then attack him. Okay, this is another time-critical situation on the offensive side. Okay? And you could put together and compare how long does it take to you since you find the service and finally attack, and then compare that to the reaction time of the organization since they find an alert and react. That's pretty much an OODA loop, like Sean Boyd said, like who does it faster has a great advantage. And then another race, this is the race, is between these people who find bugs and publish the bugs and advisories, and these people who save the bugs for later use. Why there is a race? Because anybody can independently discover the bugs. And if you use the bug on the pen test, you are probably having to give it up because your client will need a fix for it. So probably not. Depends on how you work. I mean, yep. But then you may want to save the 0 days bugs when that's the only chance you have. But if you save them for too long, somebody else will find it and publish advisory and burn your 0 day. So this is another technology race on the offensive side and between two attacking entities. Any questions on this last part? It was about the Boyd cycle and OODA loop and technology races and examples. Any questions?
No.
So for planning, we created a model. I go through this pretty fast because we only have 15 minutes left. So why do we need the model? Because we need to talk about things and we need to write things down. So we need some words. It's very simple. We have actions. That's anything you can do is an action. Assets is anything you may know or anything you can have or have control on. Those are assets. Like a host is an asset and the operating system of the host is an asset. Agents is what can do things. Agents are persons, for example, who can do the actions. And we may have software agents too. The goal is what you may want to get. It may be very specific goal for a small part of your attack, or may be the mission goal, like the whole point of your action. Costs. We are giving a cost to each action. The costs have six dimensions. We'll see later. I think this is very interesting too. Plan. It's all the actions you need to do to fulfill the goal. And attack graph is a union of all possible plans. Okay, it's the graph where you can see anything you could do. And there is something called attack trees. I think Bruce Schneier introduced this. And this is very similar. It is very similar. But we added some more stuff to... Actually, we found out after we've been doing this already, but if we compare the two of them, we have some more stuff added. What's an asset? I said it already, some examples. A given host, having TCP connectivity to port 80 of a given host is an asset. I mean, I can say, I want TCP connectivity to that host. So the answer to that question is the asset that represents the connectivity. An email address is an asset describing a person, actually. The banner on a given port is an asset because you may need it to to know the service that is running on that port, etc. And installing an agent installed on some host, a software agent installed on some host is an asset too. Because I can say, I want an agent installed on that host. And the answer to this is the agent is an asset. Yeah. The goal is expressed as a question or requirement over assets. So those are two possible goals. And the environment is the all the knowledge you have is where you are storing everything you learn. Okay, nothing should be lost. Actions. To exploit Apache chunk encoding bug is an action. I can do it. To grab a banner, to prove a host using one technique, to prove a given TCP port using some techniques, to sniff passwords, those are actions. I'm introducing this because when we are building the attack graph, we're going to use actions and assets. We see that. The plan is simple to understand that, and the attack graph is anything you could do, okay? This is the, I think, yeah. This is the cost. Cost applies to actions. Each action will cost us something. And an asset may have a cost attached. That means how much did it cost to get the asset, okay? We have these six dimensions on the cost. The noise produced by the action or the stealthiness of the action, it has to do with how much traffic it creates and if there is a signature for a given IDS and that kind of stuff. How long does it take to run the action, the exploit, the information gathering tool? What is the probability of success of the tool? How much do I trust the result? How much do I trust Nmap that it is really a Linux? Okay? These two together, probability of success and trust, is what we commonly call reliability. Okay? We split it. The traceability of an action is, can they trace back to you? And the zero dayness. Why the zero dayness? Because it has a cost. If it's a 0 days, it has a very high cost on some dimension. Okay? And then, well, agents is who are going to do the actions, and we have human agents who launch the original goal and probably may be required to, for example, craft some interesting email. And then we have software agents that may spawn new software agents. Okay, this could turn into a worm. If an agent can solve planning and can spawn different agents, that's a goal. That's a worm. That's pretty much a worm. Let me show you pretty fast how we build the graph. We start with the goal and put all the actions that can fulfill the goal. So if I want to get into a given host, I can either use, into a given domain, I can either use server exploits, person exploits, or if I have a username and password, use shell access, okay? For each of them, I have some assets that are required. I need to know the OS, the host, or the port. I need to know some addresses, email addresses, or I need to know some credentials. And for each asset, I will have somebody who will supply that. I will have an action that will answer that requirement. Okay, so the graph we are building is layered. One layer for assets, one layer for actions, one layer for assets, one layer for actions. And this goes all the way. Oh, sorry. Oh, well. Yeah. Oh, well. That was the attack graph, okay? And after I build the attack graph, I will plan over it. And this can be dynamic. I mean, if I get more information, I can feed it back to the planner and do more educated guess on what the probabilities of success are and that kind of things, or cut some branches because I know the ways. So for this very small part, it was the goal was to obtain a given host. I mean, I started with a domain, but exploits need to know an IP address or an email address. So to learn where is a host on a given domain, I can do several things. This is pretty much what we do. Like, we're going to either ping sweep the net or do something else. But we sometimes do it, and we have these six options. There may be more. We can either use ARP to prove. We can use ICMP. We can use reverse queries on DNS. We can use some TCP or UDP packets to know if the host is alive or not. But how do we usually decide which of these six tools to use? I mean, this is something we face on every pentest. Do we just run nmap with the cut and pasting from some text file? We probably do it. But for example, doing DNS reverse queries, it's way more stealth than doing ICMP, because only the DNS server will learn that. But then you may miss some hosts. So depending on your priorities, you may want to use one of them. If stealthiness is more important to you, you may probably want to do some DNS reverse queries, or if you are in the local network, you may want to discover hosts by sniffing. So the graph there is only to show that there are some decisions that we usually take that may be thought a little deeper. Okay, and this is the last slide, I think. What can be this model used for? Obviously, for attack planning manually. For risk assessment, how? Two different things. I hope nobody asks. No client asked me to do that. But if you had the full attack graph, and the client tells you what he did, you could tell how far he got into looking at your situation. I mean, if you have all these possibilities and you have the attack graph, and he walked only and the auditor only walked this path, you know that the pen test was not really complete, and that you still need to do more stuff. You can also use it for risk assessment. If you draw a graph and then identify the weakest points on the graph, you can put more strength on that and prioritize what you're going to fix first. And there is a company selling a product to do that using the Schneier's attack trees. Attacker profiling. Two different uses that fit on the same category. Either when you are going to do a pen test, depending on the priorities you give to every dimension of the coast, you'll be modeling a different attacker. Let's say, I don't care about noise, I don't care about time, I don't care about steadiness or traceability. That way I might be modeling a script kiddie. Let's say I care about zero-dayness, and I care about traceability, and I don't care about time at all. I mean, the attack may take an year. I may be modeling a foreign agency or highly skilled hacker. This can be used to evaluate the cost on the tree, on the graph, and then figure out what to do. And another use is if you have your attack graph draw and you see some IDS alerts, you can figure out where the attack is coming from, what are the tools the attacker has, and probably figure out the attacker profile. If it's a script kiddie, how do you need to defend against that, etc. This has to do with higher level IDS. The model could be used to put together some information you're gathering from different sources, because if it all fits on the graph, you will see all the nodes on the graph popping up, etc. Well, it could be used on computer-aided intrusion. That could be again, two different ways. Either have a program that will create a graph for you, or let the program tell you what to do next, or suggest what to do next, depending on what you know. It could be turned into fully automated intrusion. Fully automated intrusion. You have an agent that it's pretty smart, and you give it a goal. I think we can foresee how the attack graph could be automatically built, how it could be automatically evaluated, cut, and work, and then all the actions executed, information feedback, re-evaluated. So that's a pretty nasty automated intrusion thing. And then if you are going to develop exploits or information gathering tools, you could use a graph to see where your weakest points are. Let's say I don't have an exploit for this. Let's say I don't have a tool to know the something of a host. And you see that there are lots of actions that depend on that. Well, you would probably want to do that action first. I mean, how do you determine which exploit is better to do? How do you determine if you need to spend some time researching on TCP things or ICMP things or whatever, or remote OS fingerprinting tools? Well, this could be used to that, because if you have that graph and you see your weakest point, you can say, okay, I need to fill this hole here. Yeah, this is what we saw. Current practices to start with. I show you some more targets and how they could be used in pen tests and how they make a lot of difference. I try to convince you that doing planning before the information gathering phase may be good. I think that lots of people is doing it, but nobody realized that, or probably some did, but I think it's good to know it and then do it on purpose. I show you the Boy Cycle and OODA Loop. It was just an introduction, just to stress that there is a whole, there is a lot of literature on that area that we could benefit from. And I present you the model and then show you some examples. Any questions on anything? I have yours. Yeah, the question was, I said that currently there was a difference between attacker versus attacker and attacker versus defensor. Yeah. And that on cyber warfare scenarios, we're pretty much only seeing attacker versus defender situations. And the question was if I think that's going to change. I don't really know. I don't think it's going to change pretty much, because there are so many legal issues about that. But what I think that will change is that times will be evaluated a little more. And even when it still be defensive, it will be faster, or probably knowing that there is a difference and acting against that. I don't think there'll be reactive, not in the sense that hacking the hacker. Probably some reactive actions like cutting more ports. If you are seeing an exploit coming through port 80, you cut port 80 if you can. Or if you are seeing a distributed denial of service coming from Romania, nothing personal there. But and you are an ISP, you want to probably block it. You could probably do it. So I am seeing more reactive issues on the future, but not that it's going to react to attack the hacker. I don't think so. Yeah, sure I do. There are already a couple of things. There is it SANA security? What they are doing is, putting it simply, hooking every system call and letting the process do everything until they see a weird pattern of system calls, and then reacting to that, like filtering out system calls or doing it more slowly. If you're interested in that, that's the guy to talk with. Are you? Yeah, he knows about that. Yeah. Any other questions?
I don't know.
I think it's probably, I have an answer to that. The same reason that Russia does, because we started cracking, because software was so expensive for us. I never did cracking, of course. But. Any other questions? Okay, thanks a lot. I hope you enjoyed it. I really hope so.